Hello, and thank you so much for tuning into Stable Connections, the podcast. Today's episode is with Marisha Chilcott, and she talks to us about how one plane ride pivoted her trajectory, where she now runs Be the Change in Mental Health, a nonprofit organization making psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy and transcranial magnetic stimulation accessible to the public. Hope you enjoy. Stable Connections is sponsored by FabCo. FabCo offers beauty treatments to enhance your natural beauty in a non-invasive way. Whether you have wrinkles, sunspots, skin tags, stretch marks, loose skin, or acne, FabCo can help you out. There is no downtime, which is great for the active equestrian lifestyle. FabCo is located in Rohnert Park, California. Visit www.phabco.org to learn more. Stable Connections is sponsored by Hannah Beebe Photography. Hannah offers brand photography to equine businesses. Creating personalized content allows you to connect with your ideal client and consistently share who you are and what you have to offer. Visit www.hannahbbphotography.com to learn more.
So we are sitting in the offices of Be the Change in Mental Health. We're in Santa Rosa, and we're here because this is an organization, we're a 501c3 nonprofit that I had the audacity to start during COVID because there's a problem in our world, which is an absence or an insufficiency of mental health and wellness. And I have a fundamental belief that if we can help people feel good, not just feel good in a pleasure sense, but in an intrinsic, healthy, capable way of having true mental health, then all of the problems in our world go away. And that sounds kind of, that sounds really lofty and crazy, but if you think about it, every really horrible thing, from war to child abuse to thievery, is at some level rooted in a problem with mental health. Either it's an illness, an actual disastrous personality disorder, like narcissism with a bit of sociopathic misbehaving, or it's just desperation, or it's addiction. And those things actually come out of lack of self-worth, depression, anxiety. And those are the kinds of things, if we could make those better, all things would be better. And then, given that that's so ridiculously lofty, it's a belief that I have that making one person more well has a ripple effect across hundreds, if not thousands, of other humans. Just that one person, because you think about who you individually touch, your first little inner circle of your closest friends and family members, and then their friends and family, the people that you work with, the people you interact with in the world, at the store, at the post office, whatever else. Just making one person better affects lots of lives. So Be the Change in Mental Health was started because I read Michael Pollan's book. The book, How to Change Your Mind, opened my eyes to the possibility that there is a mechanism by which we could actually have a real influence on lots of people with respect to mental health and healing, recovering from historical traumas, even recovering from generational trauma through these modalities of using an experience in a different headspace in combination with a therapeutic intervention. So I read that book in 2018 on a trip for my 50th birthday. It was a really delightful trip, and I got to read a book that was so exciting. And I really thought, wow, that's a cool thing. I didn't think, oh, I should do something about that. So just for a little background, so I'm a physician, a doctor, and my residency training and my specialty is family medicine, which is different from internal medicine in that, at its very philosophy, family medicine thinks about the human who may happen to have some disease or not, and that that human lives in the context of a family. Internal medicine is much more focused on organ-based concepts. So your cardiologist, who started as an internist, your cardiologist thinks about the heart and things related to the heart. And they don't think so much about your knees or your bones. So then if you come to the cardiologist with a problem, it's like you are a heart. Oh, and you happen to have a body surrounding that heart. And it's just a totally different way of thinking about it. And I say that because I'm not a psychiatrist, which is where most people would think mental health interest would come from. But kind of coming back to my initial premise that all things are rooted in mental health, that this is part of family medicine. So a year or so after that, in 2019, I listened to a podcast by a doc who I really respect a lot, a guy named Peter Attia. He's anybody who's interested in health and wellness and things should check out his podcast. But he interviewed a man named Dr. Rick Doblin. And Rick Doblin has dedicated his entire life from the time he was, I think, right, maybe even still in college, so basically his entire adult life, to the re-legalization of MDMA for the use of psychological benefit. So not as a drug, but as, again, an agent to be used in psychotherapy to help people have empathy for themselves and empathy for others. So MDMA is also known as ecstasy or Molly. And it was made illegal in the 80s. And ever since then, he has been working on getting it legalized.
Specifically, a lot of times for depression, right?
More for PTSD.
PTSD.
More for PTSD. And that's been at least the narrow window through which they have been doing the clinical trials to get it approved. And I was just really impressed because his story is so beautiful in that it is the high road. Like, he could have gone off and done illegal or offshore therapy and sought that as a mode of satisfying his itch, which is to help people with this compound plus therapy. But instead, he got a PhD in public policy at the Kennedy School and learned, how can I do this through the channels that exist, which is a very slow, laborious process. And he's really a game changer. And in hearing his whole story, and I was so moved by the idea of dedicating one's life like this, that I thought, but getting it legalized is just the very beginning. Then you have to actually make it available, and available broadly. And who's going to do that? And then the next thought was, well, I thought of it, I should do it.
Is that part of your personality to be like, if no one else is doing this, or like to step up and be like, I'm going to be this person? Have you done that in the past before this?
Ironically, I can't say that I have. I'm not someone who sees obstacles. I mostly see opportunities. Like, so that is my personality. But I can't say that I've ever been someone who's like wanted to change the world. That's not been where I've come from. It's such a great question because I've never thought about it. Really. It was just more like this is a real thing. And I could see that with a change in the culture that was going to make this legal, it was going to be a big money grab. I could that was obvious. Like, oh my gosh, this thing is coming. And the way this country works is a few people go for it and make a lot of money at it. And what that would mean is that for an extended period of time, this would be only available to be blunt, rich white people. And goodness, rich white people need this, but so do everybody. So I started a nonprofit to do that.
What was the first step?
The first step was forming the nonprofit corporation and learning about nonprofits, getting a subscription to LegalZoom, like really basics, you know, yeah. Buying the, where is it? I thought I had the book. It's like, oh yeah, it is. How to Form a Nonprofit Corporation.
Yeah. Had you had much experience with nonprofits prior?
Zero. None. But it did feel like it had added up to this. So my background is weird. So I basically went to college because my friends went to college. And I literally got to go to college with my 8 best girlfriends.
And where did you go?
I went to Berkeley, to UC Berkeley. I didn't want to go to UC Berkeley. I wanted to go to UC San Diego because that was going to be the sun and the beach and the surfing, and I was from L.A.
As if Berkeley doesn't still have those things. It does, just not as much as down there.
It's different. Northern California is a different state, and when I arrived in Northern California to come to college, like, this is not California. Like, I have an image of California that looks like the Beach Boys. Like, I grew up in basically in Santa Monica. You know, horseback riding at Pepperdine University. So I was all about the beach. And so came to college, I did a tour of the campus, which means I took lots of really random classes, and then got a letter from Berkeley, I think in like my fifth or sixth semester, that said if I didn't declare a major, I was going to get kicked out.
Oh, wow. They do that.
Yeah, I didn't know they were going to do that. I didn't know that was a possibility. And then I looked at the catalog, and there was, like, if you looked at the sum of all the classes I'd taken, nothing added up to a major. I'd taken, like, chemistry and econ and women's studies and Spanish and rhetoric. That was, like, my first year, and I think I lost my scholarship at that point because, super honestly, Shauna, I majored in boys and beer.
Uh-huh. That's a lot of people in college.
Yeah. It was a really awesome major.
Yeah.
And then I had to figure out how to get a degree. And I'd been kind of a math dweeb in high school and had actually gone to UCLA while I was still in high school. So I actually had enough credits to declare a major in math, even though I hadn't taken any classes in math at Berkeley. And that was literally the only thing I could major in, like, at that point. I didn't have enough.
Yeah. So, essentially, you went to college with no direction.
I went to college with no direction.
Just following friends.
And then I graduated college. I sailed. I was actually a really, really competitive sailor.
The college was undergrad.
College was undergrad. I raced sailboats in college. And then raced sailboats after college. And
was this kind of a career path with sailing, or you just kind of were going with the flow of life?
So this is actually, this is like a therapy session. This is awesome. I'm just actually revealing that underlying it all, I don't have a lot of direction off. Or I didn't, essentially.
Yeah, it sounds like you do now, but
I do now. Yeah. I didn't then.
Like, you didn't feel the pressure to have direction, potentially.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's so interesting. I really knew I wanted to make a living, and so I thought I could just get a job and make a living, and I had a target number. Like, I thought, okay, if I can make $25,000 a year, this is 1990.
Right.
So it was a long time ago.
Right.
But that would be, like, enough. I know my rent was, like, $300 to $400 a month, and I was then living with a boyfriend. I got a job in college that then became a career job and worked for 9 years as an economic consultant to public utilities.
And you enjoyed that?
It made more than $25,000 a year.
Okay, yeah, so you enjoyed the paycheck of it.
I enjoyed the paycheck of it. I enjoyed the travel of it. I enjoyed the responsibility of it. It gave me an opportunity to take my job from Berkeley, where I'd started, to open an office for that company in Seattle, where the boyfriend that was to become my husband was going to go to graduate school, and we bought a boat, and we lived on a boat.
There's not much
around.
Sun up there. You were seeking sun for college, and then you went to Seattle.
I got so lost on my way to college, and it just kept going north. I ended up in Seattle. And I had an epiphany. So this is the crazy part. So I'm, like, misdirected, ill-directed, just kind of floating along, making a living. So first we were living together as a boyfriend and girlfriend, then we got married, and I was kind of the primary breadwinner. He was a graduate student. And I traveled a lot for work. And on a plane coming home from North Carolina, a woman had chest pain, and I was sitting in the row behind her, and they paged overhead for a doctor, and this older gentleman came and took care of her, and I now know he gave her some aspirin and nitroglycerin, asked for oxygen. We didn't have to redirect. We just all sat still when the ambulance or the paramedic crew came on board. But as we were, like, flying, and I'm listening because I'm right behind her, to this conversation, he's really taking a history. Really, you know, he's really doing a medical evaluation. But to my ears, which were layers, I'm like, it didn't sound like he had anything to say that was that special. But because he was an MD, she felt better. And I wanted to be him. And it was like this light bulb. I had never wanted anything. And, like, I want to be that guy. Because he was a doc. And I had no notion of being a physician before that. Like there's no part of my, I was in sixth grade and thought I want to be a doctor. Like, right. Nothing like that. And I spent that time on the plane writing my journal. Like, oh my gosh, remember I told you I took chemistry? I got a C in chemistry. Barely. And I'm like writing my journal. Like, oh my gosh, if I want to do this, I have to go back to college. And I have to get straight A's. And I have to kill it. And I literally came home, told who was then my husband that I want to do that. He was furious.
Because he was the one in school and finishing, you were the breadwinner.
Yeah, he was in school, and his school was going to take like another 3 years. And then if I was going to go to medical school, and his words literally was, do you realize we're going to be in living like students for another 10 years? Yeah.
That's not very supportive.
Yeah, he was mad. So I forgive him.
Yeah, well, it is a big pivot, right? Like, he thinks we're comfortable, we're going, he's going to get his degree, and then you guys are good. Yeah. And you're like, reroute.
Reroute, yeah. No, yeah. That was not positive. So then I went to college at night at University of Washington, and I still worked full-time, and I still traveled 30% time. I remember taking a physics exam in a hotel room and having to fax it to my physics professor. So fast forward, I did it. People would ask me, like, oh my gosh, do you really want to go to medical school? Is it going to be like 40 by the time you're done? And I said, I'm going to be 40 anyway. Might as well be a doctor.
Yeah. And now, do you remember that moment where you feel like now all of a sudden you had direction?
Yeah. Because I could do stuff. It gave me like a capacity to work hard. When you know what you want, you find the resourcefulness to get it. Like, that's what's so cool. There's this big difference. Tony Robbins is fond of saying resources versus resourcefulness. Like, I didn't necessarily have the resources, but I found resourcefulness because my why was so compelling. And and that's kind of like where we are today, like with this nonprofit clinic that I've built out, that I've spent the money my mom left me to build this because it's gonna work, and I will fucking make it work. So this is it. Yeah. So it adds up. So during that whole time that I talked about, like having been as a consultant, I worked. Like I learned how to run an office. I learned how to manage people. I learned how to replicate things. And then I went to medical school. I got to be a doctor. I worked in the emergency room for 6 years. I got to experience firsthand what psychopathology does. I had to do the clearances for the 5150s. I took care of the people coming in by ambulance. I took care of the folks that had to be cleared for jail. And, you know, we just dealt with a lot of, like, it's a Brooke County hospital, so it was kind of sometimes gnarly. But, you know, the thing about going to the ER is that it is your worst day. So you see a lot of humanity on the worst day of their life, even really, really nice people. And then I went and worked with, during this time that I've gotten divorced. Mm-hmm.
You were fully in, probably.
I was fully in. And I, you know, I've actually had the reconciliation with him. I've apologized that I picked my career over our marriage.
Yeah.
Full up. And
not a lot of people get to that point of being able to apologize. So even you being able to own it is huge, because a lot of people just move on. They're out of the life.
It was definitely a hard, that getting divorced was a hard time.
And you were still somewhat young. How old were you when that happened?
31.
Yeah.
I think it feels young now. 55. Yeah. I feel 31 feels really young.
I feel like 31 to get a divorce, to gone through what you have, even if you didn't necessarily have a direction, that you like were married and you were moving state to, like, there's a lot of life had happened already.
Yeah. And we've managed to stay friends. Like, that's actually been a really, really nice thing. But so what I'm saying is it kind of like added up. Like, I was a consultant, then I became a doctor, then I worked in the ER, then I worked in private practice with dad. Even though we were divorced, I came back to work with dad. So I got to see firsthand family practice, what running a medical office in the context of insurance meant. Then we took that office and we worked in the hospital setting. And then at the same time, I started another business, which is a medical aesthetics business. So I make my living now doing Botox and fillers and lasers and things like that. And that's a office just down the breezeway here. And I've spent the last 10 years learning how to run a small business successfully. I've got 13 employees and we're efficient. We have a really lovely culture. And that feels like it adds up to, I can start something new and make it something useful and bigger. And that useful and bigger is to be able to reach lots of humans, to be a model, medically facilitated psychotherapy business that serves people from all walks of life for the lowest cost possible, but to run it as a business so that we don't have to spend our entire fiscal year with our hands out trying to get donations. Like right now we're trying to raise money in order to be able to sponsor people to do this, but we should be able to run this in an efficient manner such that it, instead of having profit that goes out to shareholders, it just gets plugged back in so that we can grow and serve more people and build other offices.
I feel like, yeah, there's this big part of your life where you had kind of no direction, going with the flow, which a lot of people do, especially at that age. Just kind of going to college because we felt like we were supposed to or needed to, and then that one plane ride or that one moment where you're like, complete pivot. Are you a believer that everything happens for a reason?
Do I believe in predetermined things? Not exactly. I don't exactly feel like there's a bigger plan, except that it does feel like the universe conspires to facilitate success if your reasons are aligned with whatever the universe has.
Right, so, we come up with the reasons.
Yeah, and you know, I think that the challenge with believing too much in a bigger plan is then it feels like, well, then why does all this other, like, why does the Holocaust have to happen? Or why do Hamas and Israel have to be in a total disaster situation right now? And there's horrible things that happen to people. So I hold that at the same time as I also hold that there's a lesson and it's the meaning we give what happens rather than that something happens. Like, having my marriage fall apart was the worst possible thing. But without it, I couldn't have had the rest of my life evolve the way it has. And I'm really pleased with the rest of the way it has. So, I don't know.
I think that's a good answer. And I think I very much believe in a friend of mine's dad who has passed away since saying this, but he has said, life is made up of inches and seconds.
Yes.
So if you were five rows back in that airplane, right, would you have been paying so much attention?
Yeah.
Or if you didn't move up to Seattle, if you didn't have the like years of experience doing those other things, like if you right in, you know, sixth grade, you were like, I want to open a nonprofit and I want to do this and I want to do this, right, you wouldn't be where you are. Maybe you would have still opened it, but it wouldn't look how it looks because you had all that other experience.
Right.
So I do believe that everything happens for a reason because I give the reason for all those things. I actually read a little meme that was like, life is 10% what happens and 90% your reaction to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And exactly. That's huge. Like, it's not what actually happens to us. It's the tools that we've had and the way we're able to process it and get through it or not.
Right.
That actually matters.
Right. And what's really incredible is that whatever meaning you've given it, at this point, you can rewrite that narrative. And a lot of what we do here is help people rewrite a narrative in order to make it constructive so that you can actually keep going and be better and actually bloom. And also be aware that the nature of life is that there are ups and downs. And if it were just steady, beautiful, pure joy all the time, that would be boring and unsustainable. And so to also get comfortable with the dance of the difficulty, with the ease, with the sadness and the joy, that's learned and that we can help people learn that. And then that's mental wellness. That's the juice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without the sad, the angry. I mean, I think of the Pixar movie Inside Out.
Yes,
anytime I think
such a great
they're coming
movie.
Out with a second one too.
Oh, so good.
But yeah, like I always think about that without those quote unquote negative emotions, you wouldn't have so much joy because joy wouldn't feel joyous anymore if it's the only thing you feel.
Right.
And so we need kind of the plethora of all the different
right.
emotions.
Right.
For
we,
sure.
We need that juxtaposition of feeling. And it's also like, you know, it's like the athlete's experience of discomfort when you're training. When you're working really hard, when you're at that point where it's painful, but you get to decide what that pain means. And I heard a great thing recently is understanding the difference between, is this pain injury or is this pain discomfort? And being able to distinguish between those things can help you not get injured because you can avoid an overuse, but to know that some of that pain is required in order to be able to grow, in order to get faster, in order to be able to get stronger. Like that's a critical component. And so that's a really easy way for people to recognize that we all at different times are aware of pain versus suffering, and suffering is giving a negative meaning to pain.
Yeah, definitely. So going back to what you do now, 2020,
yeah,
COVID happens, yeah, and you decide to open this. So tell me about that initial thought process. And you said step one was learning about, you know, 501c3s, yes, and all of that. So
right. So it's laid out the corporate structure, and then this physical space that we're in was an empty space that was for lease, and I had office space in this same building, and I really thought the only way I can make this happen and still balance another job also is if it's literally physically in proximity. And so I talked to the landlord, an incredible man who has since passed, and he believed in my idea enough to wait for it, make an unsecured loan to me to build this place out. So no place else could you get a loan to, no cash down, build a 3,500 square foot beautiful new office space with a multitude of walls and new bathrooms and things. I mean, it's incredible. So at the same time, so we're still in COVID, so it took a long time to actually get built because of the challenges of that time with respect to getting building permits and so forth. But we really did the kind of field of dreams things and built it first, and then have been now pulling the patients in. And I have wonderful folks helping me. Like Gianna has been this, she's my sister in love. I'm my ex-husband, ended up getting married to the most beautiful, most wonderful, most accomplished woman. And she has been working as the director of business development for Be the Change and has just made it rain. It's really, really cool. So first we built the clinic, and now we're bringing in the patients, and it's so great. And we're serving people. So I, just for clarity, I'm the doctor, I'm not the therapist. We have PhD psychologists that are specifically trained in these modalities that are the folks that both do the evaluations and then do the therapy itself when we're using ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. So we just say the MDMA, Rick Doblin's dream, is still in the works. It has been, I've been paying attention and not paying attention close enough. It is very likely that the FDA will approve in August of 2024 the use of MDMA with a specific protocol for PTSD. We still kind of have to have our fingers crossed, and it's not a done deal yet. That said, psilocybin is also something that people are looking at and is being studied, and there's lots of good buzz about. And both of those medications, both psilocybin and MDMA, are at this point, we're in January 2024, are illegal substances. They are Schedule I. They are absolutely not something a legitimate physician or therapist who wants to keep their license at this point can
utilize. Use. Yeah.
Right. But there's this other medication called ketamine, which is well known in the equestrian community and in the veterinarian community and in the ER human community because we use it as an anesthetic agent. So it is a medicine that is a dissociative anesthetic that has as a side effect an incredible ability to increase neuroplasticity, and that just medication alone causes an antidepressant, anti-anxiolytic effect for about 14 days. It's not long lasting. So it's a medicine that we use here as, I like to call it a lubricant, but as an adjuvant to therapy, because after you receive the medication for the first several days right afterwards, you are much more able to have a new perspective and see a different way of being and feel differently in the world. And then if you then use that tool that the therapist helps you define, you can then have a new way of living and a new way of being. And it helps with recovering from trauma, but it also just helps from
the quality of life.
Quality of life. Yeah. Just being able to see how your life can be better and then activating it.
How is the ketamine put into the body? Like, what is the process with that?
Sure. So ketamine is available as an injectable medication and as a compounded medication for underneath the tongue or an oral agent. There's also esketamine, which is a nasal inhalant. We use injectable ketamine as an IM injection because it's easy, it's clean, and it's dosed by weight.
Weight of the body it's going into?
Of the human, yeah, exactly. We don't use lozenges or orals because the bioavailability is not as good, it's slower, and IM medicines are easy to control. So there's something called the first pass effect, where if you swallow something and put it into your stomach and then it goes into your intestine and gets absorbed into the bloodstream, that bloodstream, the very first thing it does is go past your liver. That's called the first pass effect. And as it goes past your liver, a lot of it gets filtered out. And so you have then less. So if you take things orally, you often have to take much higher doses in order to have an effect. And then the liver also has to work hard to get it out because it sees it as doesn't belong here. Poison, make it go away. So when you do something sublingually, then you're actually having it pass through the mucosa of the mouth. Then it kind of gets into the bloodstream and skips the liver. But again, it just doesn't actually move very quickly. Whereas hypodermic needle through your arm into your deltoid, there it is. It's medicine, goes right into those little capillaries that the muscle's full of, and it works within 2 to 3 minutes.
And with, because I don't know that much about all of this, with the ketamine injections, are there negative side effects?
The primary side effect of ketamine is that it does elevate blood pressure by about 20 millimeters of mercury. So if you have if you say your blood pressure is 130 over 70, that means it's 130 millimeters of mercury is how much it gets raised, blah, blah. Anyway. 20 points, call it, of both. So if someone has uncontrolled hypertension or risks of a stroke or something like that, then that elevation of blood pressure can be problematic. That's really the only significant side effect other than nausea. So at the time of administration, people can have nausea. So here in our office, because we're a medical office, we manage those things by pre-medicating people to prevent nausea, to prevent vomiting, and to prevent elevated blood pressure. So we check people's blood pressures ahead of time, and then we have kind of a host of medications that are useful to just control that at a temporary basis. Most people that are healthy and have a normal blood pressure, it's fine to have your blood pressure go up just a little bit. When you exercise, your blood pressure goes up by 20.
Do all patients that come here get that?
No.
Okay. Is there a common age that comes in here? What kind of clientele?
We see a really wide range of ages and folks, from people who want to improve their performance to people that are really struggling with severe depression or severe anxiety. We don't treat schizoaffective disorder. We don't treat schizophrenia. Those are the two primary mental illnesses that are thought to be problematic with dissociative medications because it's a dissociative disease to begin with. But so I built this place and then didn't want to be a one-trick pony, so to speak, because there's only ketamine. We don't have MDMA yet. We don't have psilocybin. And so we also have a modality that's known. It's called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which literally means transcranial passes through the cranium. Magnetic stimulation is magnetic energy that goes into the brain. This is a device that is FDA approved that treats depression, anxiety, OCD, and actually the fourth FDA indication is smoking cessation. So where the energy is put in the brain varies by what you're trying to treat, but it's incredibly effective. It's been around for a long time.
20 years-ish.
But it hasn't gotten a lot of awareness because it's slow. And because the way the machine manufacturers have marketed it, psychiatrists, who are the primary doctors who would prescribe it, don't really have the personality type or the office setup to have someone come to their office every single day for 30 to 36 days in a row for 20 to 40 minutes and sit in the office. Like, most psychiatrists have a smaller facility and blah, blah, blah. It just doesn't really fit for them.
So it hasn't been as recognized. Is it non-invasive? Is it considered non-invasive? That's also probably part of it. Similar to in the horse world, I feel like, you know, injections or different things that are a little bit invasive, but usually like kind of a quick thing, are more sought after and noticed than the non-invasive machines.
Slower, yeah. very effective, but you got to do it every day sort of thing. So there's been a lot more interest recently in TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, because there have been some new studies from Stanford. There's a really famous psychiatrist named Nolan Williams, whose lab has been doing studies on more rapid use. So multiple treatments in a single day given in the course of 5 days and curing major depressive disorder, where someone has had multiple different kinds of medications, often suffered for years, if not decades, and have been just intractable, and they are better in like literally 2 days. It's really remarkable. Insurance is not yet paying for these faster protocols, but they are super exciting. So here at Be the Change, we are offering, if people don't want to go through their medical insurance, we can actually offer them more rapid treatment.
And in the moment, I don't know if you've done it on yourself, but in the moment, do you feel anything?
Yes. So people feel a sensation of kind of tapping on their head. People typically describe it as like a woodpecker on their head. It's not painful.
It feels like it's on, not in.
You know what?
You don't know.
I haven't asked that.
Okay.
I don't know because I haven't been treated. I've felt what the pulses have felt like just to be, so you have to be mapped. So it's really cool because you're like, how do you know where you put it in the brain? You need to put it in a very specific location that's about the size of a walnut called, for depression, you put it on the left dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex.
It makes sense that you would put it on different parts of your brain that does different things.
Exactly. Yeah. And so for anxiety, you put it on the right dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex.
Does it matter left-hand, right-handed people?
No. Isn't that wild?
That is weird. Yeah.
It's really wild. And what's really interesting is sometimes depression comes from anxiety, or anxiety and depression are mixed together. But depression acts like a brake on anxiety. So if you treat depression and someone has a big anxiety component, you can make their anxiety a lot worse.
Right.
And so part of our psychological assessment is to figure out, like, do you have depression? Do you have anxiety? Do you have anxiety causing depression? Which one is it? And we will often treat the anxiety component first in order to make sure that's controlled and better before we release the depression. Part of it's just, it's so crazy, is that, so the sound, if you will, because that's kind of like what the energy sounds like, it goes like this.
Oh, it's fast.
On the left side.
Oh, okay.
To speed up the depressed brain that's slow and doesn't want to go. The anxious brain, it's kind of like little bird-like.
It's already fast.
It's already fast. That energy goes like this. That, and it's like it's forcing those brain waves. And this is kind of my analogy in my head of like forcing the brain to slow down and pulse normally. And just treating that anxious component just on the right side when the depression is caused by the anxiety makes the depression lift too. So I just think it's so fascinating. What's really interesting is that biomechanically, ketamine, which I told you causes this antidepressant effect just by itself as a medicine, and TMS seem to have some common pathways. And both of them seem to cause new neuroplasticity and increased capacity in the same mechanism for depression.
Can someone be on both modalities at the same time?
Yes. And there are some clinical trials that have demonstrated additive or even multiplicative efficacy. We had one patient who did it maybe a year and a half ago now. She's still doing really remarkably well. She's actually a very accomplished horsewoman, did dressage for many years. But because she traveled to see us and she was on a shorter timeline, she had done TMS before. And she said, I want to do TMS again, but I really want to try this ketamine. And we found the literature that demonstrated it was safe. So we gave it a go, and she's done really, really well. Now, truthfully, she's done some other things also.
I feel like life changes have to be, or, you know, there's certain things that have to be in at the same time.
One of my favorite sayings at this point is better living through chemistry requires better living. Like, as you get better from depression, anxiety, you have to do the things in life that actually are the value and keep you there. So when you're really depressed and you don't feel like exercising and you're not eating healthfully and you're staying indoors, once your depression starts to lift, you can get out and do those things. Then you need to get out and do those things.
Yeah.
Because then that's what keeps you out of the depression.
Yeah.
And so my analogy with ketamine is I love to say it's like a blizzard in your brain, because you go through this ketamine session and you're dissociated and it's kind of hallucinogenic and it's this really trippy, wild experience. And then you come out of it and it's like there's really nice, clean snow. Then the therapy, the importance of that is you have to cut new trails in your life. You have to decide how you're going to live life differently, how you're going to see things differently. And if you've ever walked in hip-deep snow, walking once doesn't make a trail. You got to walk back and forth and back and forth on this new trail. And that's why the therapist helps you redo some of those pathways. And then you live that life. And yeah. Then you keep, and you basically work in a new groove.
Yeah.
Instead of your old groove.
With the therapy side of things, do you just utilize talk therapy, or are there other kinds of like therapy modalities?
So it's all variations of talk therapy. There's lots of different schools of thought within talk therapy. There's cognitive behavioral, there's
EMDR.
So we don't do any EMDR here. One of the things that's really amazing, and Gianna will probably speak to this at some point too, about ketamine-assisted therapy is you don't have to relive trauma to get better from it. You don't have to have to explain to the therapist about the worst day of your life in order to recover from it. It does not make memories go away. It helps you make a new meaning for the memory, or just recategorize it in a way that it happened, and because of that I'm stronger and more able, whatever else. It's really different. So I've done EMDR. So also for a little context, so I have suffered from major depressive disorder, and I've had two really severe episodes, and one was nearly fatal. And that is another compelling component of why I feel so motivated to help people through this, because it's a terrible place to be. You never want to go again. And in the medical model, we think of depression as a chronic recurrent disease. And when we talk about recovering from depression, we talk about getting to a place of remission, and that you may need a little tune-up occasionally to stay healthy and stay well, to avoid recurrence. So yeah. Lots of times people ask, like, oh my gosh, so does this mean you're cured? And the answer is you're way better. But it's like if you train for an event, if you put all of your energy and get super, super fit and make your PR out of marathon or complete some phenomenal level of whatever sport you're in, unless you continue training, you lose that level of fitness. And so just like that with mental health, like you get a lot better, but you then have to do the better
work
living.
The muscle.
You got to keep working the muscle.
Yeah. That makes sense. So in those moments in your life where it was very deep depression, because a lot of these modalities are on the newer side, what helped you through?
So I did not have these modalities available to me. So the first really severe case, I was actually a resident. And I was lucky enough to be in a residency where they had incredible support services for their residents. And I have my class of residency classmates to thank, because my workload had to be absorbed by all my other classmates, and residents are already working so hard. So I was held by my community and allowed to take the time off. Quite frankly, I wasn't just allowed, I was forced, I was benched. I got benched for 5 weeks. Or 6 weeks. And during that time, I got medication and I got really intensive therapy from two different therapists, and it got me out of that. And I was really, really lucky. And then maybe 5 years later, I had another episode and again got saved really, really luckily. And I have told myself, I'm not doing that again. Never going there again. So now I have a better sense of like when the warning signs come out, and I get,
you get help.
I get help. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, as a woman, one of the things that's really shocking though is to recognize that all those things that worked when you were 25, 35, 45, stop, 40, 45. Like at 45, perimenopause time, things can get very, very different. And the hormonal milieu of first perimenopause and then menopause itself is a time when it is worth getting assistance to manage those things, because you're not crazy, but your hormones are not serving you. and
and so your body's different now.
Your body's different, but your hormones are literally like they're not there to serve you, and then they've got too much, and that's not serving you. Like it's a nutcase making time in life. I highly recommend women in general, at the point they're in perimenopause, to start seeking assistance with hormone replacement therapy. There are very, very few true contraindications. The teaching of physicians in my generation and those just a little older than me are based on something called the Women's Health Initiative, and it is a complete disservice to women. And it has deprived two, if not three, generations of women from really appropriate health care. You know, when people say, oh, it's not natural to take hormones, it's not natural to live past 45 and not have 13 children. There's a whole lot that's not natural, and I will go with not natural.
You'll go with sanity.
And it relates to cardiovascular health, and it relates to intellectual health and keep retaining your cognitive ability. Hormone replacement is really, really worth it. It's easier to have prepared for a situation than be chasing a solution. Sarah Gottfried has written a really fantastic book called The Hormone Solution. It's a definite recommended read for women of all ages, starting actually in your 30s, because mm-hmm. one of the problems with our patriarchal medical society is that it has repeatedly and ongoingly discredited women for their absolute lived experience and gaslighted us into thinking we're crazy, starting with, you know, PMS and going right into menopause and any of a number of things. You know, most clinical trials are done just on men. And then the expectation is that the medications designed for and tested on men should work the same way in women. And many times they do, but sometimes they don't. And it's my really fundamental belief as a physician that when a patient comes in and tells you this medicine doesn't work, but the one I got last month did, generic drugs are not the same month to month from the pharmacy. They have different binders in them. They have different dyes in them. They have different concentrations of the actual active ingredient. Ready for another one? There's a book called A Bottle of Lies. It's about the generic drug industry, and it's very alarming. And the drug industry in general is alarming. So I am not a naysayer in allopathic medicine. I'm trained in that modality.
Allopathic, what does that mean?
Allopathic medicine is the school of medical training that results in someone getting an MD. Osteopathic medicine results in you getting a DO. Either MDs or DOs can then go to residency programs, and they can be MD or DO residency programs. There's lots of crossover. And then with that training, you can apply to be a physician or surgeon and get a license to practice medicine in this country. Distinct from having been trained in homeopathic medicine or chiropractic medicine. And there are lots of MD DOs that would argue chiropractors are not medical doctors. And technically, because they cannot prescribe medications, they're not. There's also naturopathic medicine, NDs. And depending on the state, they may or may not be allowed to practice medicine and prescribe medications. It's a lot of just, it comes down to semantics and legal and also political. Like the reason why most of us know doctors our MDs is because in the 1800s, the AMA had the strongest political body and lobbying force in the federal government. I mean, so many things that we think of and take as truth are rooted in a history of politics.
So back to this place, because it's on the newer side, how long have you been open? When did you officially open your doors?
So we officially opened our doors in March of 2022.
Okay, so about 2 years ago.
We're coming up on 2 years. Yeah, we're coming up on 2 years.
And how is it feeling so far, and what have some of the major struggles been?
I would say the major struggle is getting the word out enough to let people know that this is available, that it's legal, that it's safe, that it's medically regulated and supervised, and that it works. Like it's just getting the news out. Because there's lots of confounding news, because there's lots of research being done on things that are still illegal, it's not so clear to people what is and what is not. What's been great is just the success. the successes of the individuals. You know, like I've said so many times, like just changing one person's life will make this worthwhile. And there are now hundreds of people whose lives have been changed. And that is so gratifying.
Yeah. With the ketamine process, someone comes in and you said it lasts about 14 days, but in the beginning, like what does that look like if someone came in for that modality?
So backing up just a little bit, lasting 14 days, there have been lots and lots of clinical trials just using ketamine as a medication and not doing any therapy, because therapy is harder to control for. So that's where we just know that the antidepressant effects chemotherapeutically, just using medication, lasts about 14 days. What it looks like, because that's insufficient for me, like I'm not satisfied with somebody having to take medicine regularly. The goal is to have people get better. And so to do that, we use the therapy is the proven modality. So we have kind of two sort of branches, if you will, of approach. One is if you're generally well and you just want a tune-up, you just want to feel like let's take it one more level up. I'm not trying to deal with some big trauma. I'm not seriously depressed right now. I don't even have any anxiety. I just want to just level up one. You can come in and do what's just called an experience. And to do that, you come in, you meet with our psychologist, and they do basically an initial 1 hour intake and initial therapy session. And they say, yep, you don't have any hidden traumas that you haven't actually even told yourself about, and we'll do an experience. And then you schedule again, and you come in for a preparatory session and a medication session, and those are held on the same day. So it's anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour of preparation. And that's where you are describing to yourself, but saying out loud to the therapist, this is where I am, and this is where I want to be. Here's point A, where I am, and what my intention is, or what I want to get out of this, is point B. There's a really big difference between an intention and an expectation, and they guide you on that. So you set your intention, and in between these two, you've been seen by either myself or one of the nurse practitioners or physician's assistants, and has been seen to be medically checked out, and they've also written orders for the nurses to give you medicine for nausea, medicine to control your blood pressure if your blood pressure is a little on the high side, medicine to control anxiety if you're kind of nervous about the experience, and then also instructions on how much ketamine to give you based on your weight. How much is a function of your baseline anxiety as a human, your previous experience with psychedelic medicines, your intention to only do one versus four or five or six. We literally have a factor calculation to then say this person's going to get 0.75 milligrams per kilogram. So you've done the preparation, you then are getting ready for the medication, the psychologist then pages the nurse comes in and gives you medication, and you lay on the couch with your eye shades on and music on a headset in your ears, and you get to go to inner space or outer space or wherever it is.
You have your experience.
Yeah. Yep. And the whole time the therapist is there with you. And they've already determined with you whether or not you want to have your hand held or a shoulder touched or if you want no contact. And if you get scared, the people ask, oh my gosh, what if I have a bad trip? That's why the therapist is there, is to guide you. And there's no such thing as a bad trip. There can be hard trips. There can be things that are scary. But if there's something scary, the therapist is there to let you know you are okay and to walk toward it, because there's something to learn. No matter what is going on, there is something to learn, something to be had in the medication state. Then you slowly land. So anywhere from 20 to 40 to 60 minutes in, you start to feel like, oh, I'm kind of coming back to normal. And usually it looks like this. And I know we're on radio, so people can't see, but they're lying with the mask. And they go, okay. And that's where the skylight is not popular.
I see. Yes.
And they're like, okay. And sometimes there's like, I'm going to stay in a little bit. Or sometimes we're like, okay, I'm done. And they sit up a little bit, and the therapist talks to them, and they kind of do what's called a landing. But people are still, to be frank, a little intoxicated, can't walk, can't drive. Someone has to drive them home, or they take a lift. But they spend another while in the clinic before being discharged out. And then they come back the next day or within 2 to 3 days and have a therapy session with that same therapist. And they go over, so point A was where you were, Point B was where your intention was. Where are you? And inevitably, they're at point C.
Yep.
It's not A or B.
Yep.
Nobody's ever still at A. And sometimes C is past B. Sometimes it's almost a B. Sometimes it's in a totally different direction altogether. But then the therapy is about talking about, okay, so do you even want to still go towards B anymore? Like sometimes you have a whole new perspective such that that's not even the direction you want to go anymore. And other times it's just revelatory. And then it's like, okay, so now how do we stay on that track? How do we drive that groove in? So that's a one-time experience. But if during your initial evaluation with a psychologist, it's been revealed like, oh, you know, you got some stuff to work on actually. And if there's been a lot of trauma, if there's a lot to be addressed, the therapist may say, you know what, this is going to be great for you, but we need to do a little bit of ground laying and we need to do some therapy sessions first. And so they may require work out with you. We're going to do 3 therapy sessions before we do a medicine session. And then we're going to do 6 medicine sessions. We're going to do And by medicine session, it's a triad of preparation, medication, therapy. That's a cycle of sessions. And why do we do 6? Because that's what the literature shows.
And how back-to-back are they? Like how many days between?
So most typically people do them about 1 a week or every 2 weeks. So it's usually like we do medicine and prep and medicine Wednesday, therapy on Thursday or Friday, or prep and medicine on Monday, sometime during the week, and then kind of go week to week. Sometimes, especially people have come from out of town, it can be like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. The most you can do is 3 because we're not open 7 days a week. So you can do it as tight as 2 a week and as spread out as once a month. There's kind of some value to letting things marinate. Like you do get more done because it's kind of more about like having more time to build that new trail.
Is there anything that you haven't talked about that you want to make sure you talk about?
So one thing I want to mention is that ketamine-assisted therapy makes regular talk therapy feel so slow. Like people come out of ketamine-assisted therapy and like, oh my gosh, I've been in therapy for 10 years and I can't believe how much I just got done in 2 weeks. Like it's really remarkable. And in the last 6 months, actually not even, it's just since October. Oh my gosh, time feels so long and so short all at the same time. We started doing group retreats and group sessions in October, and that has made single individual therapy look so slow. Like ketamine assisted group therapy is. It's like lightning fast, but so deep. And people just get so much out of it.
And is it groups that people don't know each other?
Yeah, they come in strangers and they are immediately like just
drawn. Yeah.
It's not even drawn. It's more like just there's an intimacy that develops really, really quickly. And this is so fascinating because it's not gender specific. We have only done them as single gender groups. And to be super transparent to the trans community out there, we haven't had a significant trans group yet. We have definitely seen trans patients, but we've done retreats with women in beautiful settings. They go from being strangers to sisters in like hours. Mm-hmm. And it's what, and then they're sisters that stay together and have relationship beyond the retreat. It's really, really cool. Here in the clinic, we're doing groups for first responders, and those have been honestly men. We're doing actually a group for female firefighters coming up. So far we've done just men, and even those, you know, they're dudes and they're tough, but they're humans. And this medication combination with group in a safe environment that is totally confidential with people who understand where you're coming from because they have shared professional experiences, it just dissolves and happens. It's really cool. I am very, very excited about group therapy also because it makes it easier to afford. You know, one of the things that makes this really a challenge is even though we're a nonprofit and even though we are probably 20 maybe even as close to 25% less expensive than other clinics that do what we do around the greater Bay Area, it's still a big number that can be uncomfortable for people. The other group that we're really interested in helping out are veterans. And there are lots and lots of veterans out there. if anyone calls, one of the first things that our staff asks is, are you a first responder? Are you married to a first responder? Are you a veteran? All of those folks get 10% off just automatically, because it's a privilege to have folks serving our communities in these ways, and this is one of the wings that we want to really support folks. We haven't started any veterans groups yet, because veterans represent a much more diverse group. People have really, really different jobs in the armed services, and so just because you were in the Navy and I was in the Navy, if I'm a doc and you're a fighter pilot, our lives,
the worlds are different.
The worlds are totally different, and so we are working with veterans and talking to them about how we can try to make this more effective. But in the meantime, there's legislation that's being pushed through at the federal level that may make this something as a VA benefit really soon, we're hoping. There needs to be something that we can actually just swoop in. And ketamine-assisted therapy, just ketamine period, has been proven to help acute suicide. As in, like, get you out of that headspace.
State,
get it out of that state and turn that off.
Let's go into the question. So what is something within the community you want to see evolve or change? And then how can you help with that if you're not already? And you obviously are helping with a lot of change.
How can I help, or how can the world help?
Both. Sometimes how you can help also influences the listener. Yeah.
So the one thing I want to see change in the world, in the community at large, is a change in the perspective on what it means to be mentally healthy and well, and that, and to take away a stigma about not being perfectly healthy. Like, there shouldn't be a stigma about not being perfectly physically fit. We all know we want to be more fit. We all know we want to be healthier. We can all do more. And so, you know, this is bringing awareness to another tool that helps anyone can be better. Like, no matter who you are, no matter where you're starting from, we have a modality here that helps you be even better. So if you're starting out not feeling good or even feeling terrible, we can get you to feeling reasonably good or even great. And if you're feeling great, we can get you to feeling freaking phenomenal. And when you feel really great, you're unstoppable. So if we have a whole bunch of humans out in the world that are unstoppable, that makes a better world.
Yeah.
So,
and starting with that one person, it all just kind of ripple effects, like you talked about.
Exactly. And so part of that, too, is having people talk about it to each other and take it out of the realm of stigma, taking it into the realm of, this is something that I'm going to do and get better. Hey, you want to try this? Let's do this. There are more people that are willing to do it, to do something when there's been social proof, it's called, right? And so some of that social proof comes from people talking about when they've been through this. And what's really interesting is when you start talking about this, people's like, oh, wait, I have a friend. They did this. Or wait, I've got a neighbor. Or even, oh, I did it. I just didn't tell anybody. And like, okay, start talking about it. There's no shame. This is great.
And then lastly, you get to ask me one question.
I'm most curious about what intrigued you the most about what you've learned today from me.
The drive. I think it's really empowering to know that you had, you know, 30 years or so of just kind of like going through life, trying to figure it out. And then that one moment where you're like, I'm going to do this. And there's not a time limit to that. Some people do that at 70 years old. Sometimes they do it at 10 years old. So I like the consistent reminder of that, that like, just because what I'm doing now is what I'm doing now, there are other things and other experiences that might completely reroute. And right. I think that's really fun to think in that way.
I love that. And I love that you're drawn to that, because people will say to me things like, oh, I should have done this. Like, God, you're not dead.
Do it.
Just start part of it. Even if it's easier to bite it out, I mean, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Please don't eat elephants. That's disgusting. But just start.
Take that step.
And then you take another step. And that's really how you climb big mountains, is one step at a time. Inches and seconds.
Yeah. Well, and you might start taking that step and be like, actually, this isn't for me, but I learned a lot, and now let's go to this side.
Right. And you get to a different point B, and you see something else and do something else then. But like, this life is for living, and we are spirits experiencing a human thing. And to just kind of squeeze as much of the humanity out of our lives as we can and do what we can.
Yeah.
That's great.
Definitely. Awesome. Well, thank you for chatting with me. That was very fun.
Shauna, thank you so much. Great.
Hello again, and thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode of Stable Connections, the podcast. For the first 2 years, I put out episodes every single Monday. Now, they're going to come out kind of sporadically, sometimes every week, sometimes once a month. But if you listen to an episode and enjoy it, please leave a comment, share it with your friends, share it on your story, and if you have the time, please leave a review on Facebook, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Thank you so much. See you next time.